This is Basic Criminal Procedure Review Series Part 3 of our 7 parts. And for this episode, we are going to take a look at frisk, protective sweeps, arrest, Miranda, and then wrap up talking about vehicle stops and address cameras a little bit. So let's review stop expectations from episode 2. Even without suspicion of wrongdoing, a police officer can approach someone and begin a conversation without violating the Fourth Amendment, as long as the individual reasonably feels free to end the discussion and walk away. The officer has done nothing wrong. You as a police officer need to be comfortable and practiced at approaching and engaging people in conversations that have absolutely nothing to do with suspicion of or actual wrongdoing. And citizens, we need citizens to be comfortable and confident in approaching you as a police officer. But if that encounter is a conversation based on a suspicion of wrongdoing or interaction, it's an investigatory stop, investigatory detention or stop. In order to stop or detain someone, the police must have reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. That is, an objectively reasonable basis to suspect that the detainee is or was involved in a crime. As we established in the second session, much more than a hunch. If it is a stop, it must be brief and long enough or only long enough for the officer to assess the situation. And we talked a little bit about that. That's where you're focused. You're dialed in. You know, you're not dilly-dallying. Your senses are up and you're paying attention to what's being said or actions, etc. In Illinois, we have a statutory expectation for stops. 725 ILCS 5/107-14 is titled Temporary Questioning Without Arrest. And as you know, it provides that a peace officer, after having identified himself as a peace officer, may stop any person in a public place for a reasonable period of time when the officer reasonably infers from the circumstance that the person is committing, is about to commit, or has committed an offense, and may demand the name and address of the person and an explanation of the person's actions. Think back to those scenarios that we discussed in episode 2. Statute goes on to provide that such a detention and temporary questioning will be conducted in the vicinity of where the person was stopped. So right there, where you encounter the individual. So essentially, all the expectations we covered in the episode 2 are addressed in our statute. And then, as we all know, there's a paragraph B that provides that upon completion of any stop under Section A involving a frisk or search, and unless impractical or impossible under the circumstances, the officer is supposed to provide the person with a stop receipt, provides the reason for the stop, and contains the officer's name and badge number. So while there's not as much statutory guidance concerning the frisk under this statute, frisks are acknowledged in 725 ILCS 5/108-1.01, which provides when a peace officer has stopped a person for temporary questioning pursuant to Section 107.14, and reasonably suspects that he or another is in danger of attack, he may search the person for weapons. If the officer discovers a weapon, he may take it until completion of questioning, at which time he shall either return the weapon if lawfully possessed or arrest the person so questioned. Illinois courts have consistently interpreted the expectation of this statute. The right to frisk does not automatically follow the right to stop. The sole justification of such a search is protection of the police officer and others nearby, and not to gather evidence. So that needs to be the focus. So at the end of the day, your facts must in some way dictate a concern for safety, yours or others nearby. But what about asking for consent for a frisk? Now, that's a topic for another class or another episode, and we can all think of a coworker who could probably put, and maybe it's you, probably put on a class on the practical aspects of these types of requests. But we'll discuss consent a little bit at the throughout the episodes, and it's just a question to keep in mind. We'll discuss it in the context of vehicle stops in a little bit in this episode, but just a question, you know, what you see it, it's practice. Some of you have policies or you've, whether it's written or not, you have been taught possibly by a really good FTO on how you might work that request. Hey, do you care if I pat you down? You know, for my safety. Happens. Let's move on to protective sweeps. A protective sweep is a limited search that police are allowed to conduct when they arrest someone. Okay, you can utilize a protective sweep when you've arrested someone. The purpose of a protective sweep is to allow officers to ensure their own safety and that of those on or at the scene. And it's to search the vicinity of the arrest. The search is for people who may pose a threat. Now, although the Fourth Amendment generally requires that officers have warrants before searching homes, the protective sweep doctrine is an exception. And if police discover evidence of criminal activity that is in plain view while conducting a protective sweep, typically you can use that evidence against the defendant at trial. Typical protective sweep scenarios involve officers having an arrest warrant for someone and needing to enter a home to make the arrest. Protective sweeps can also involve arrests near homes, at the entrance, for example, and arrests in other kinds of buildings. To guard against unexpected attacks from unseen people in the home, the police are typically allowed to perform at least some kind of limited search of other parts of the premises. Now, this kind of protective sweep doesn't require suspicion. It involves officers searching closets and other spaces immediately adjoining the location where an arrest takes place. Places from which an attack by some concealed person could immediately be launched. This type of sweep doesn't require probable cause or reasonable suspicion that any danger actually exists. And I, in the written materials, cite Maryland v. Bowie, 494 U.S. 325. The second kind of sweep is based on danger in the air. Those are the terms used by the court. Danger in the air. And it's based on immediate circumstances, allowing officers to take a broader look around the premises if they have reason to believe that there's an actual danger of attack. In other words, police must be able to point to facts that would lead a reasonably prudent officer to believe that the area to be swept actually harbors someone posing a threat. We all know what those circumstances could be. Later we'll talk about video. It's likely that right from your chest, whatever that circumstance may be or should be or hopefully is within the video. Because protective sweeps are for the safety of officers and others, not for gathering evidence, they have to be limited in time and scope. And we talk about factors of time and scope, or time and circumstances and place and time, as we've established all throughout the law, especially procedural law. A lawful protective sweep isn't a full search, but rather a cursory inspection of places where a person could be hiding. It's what the court tells us, so we keep it to that. And of course, if we're going in with a warrant and you had facts that indicated that you might want to be looking for something else, well, then you had the facts to present and have a warrant to allow for a more extensive search. In deciding whether a protective sweep was reasonable, courts tend to look at the totality of the circumstances, just like they do anything else we've talked about, right? In other words, all the relevant factors. And here's some of the factors that the courts have considered. The seriousness of the charges against the person being arrested. Armed robbery, for instance, tending to create more cause for concern than unpaid traffic tickets. Reports that third parties are inside the premises. And again, you're going to have facts, right? It's not just a feeling. Suspicious movements, words, or actions by people at the scene. And again, most likely, to your protection, you're going to have video that would be able to back up suspicious movements, words, or actions by people at the scene. The lighting inside the premises, how confined the premises might be, the proximity of the spaces searched to the location of the arrest. In other words, the immediately accessible areas. Let's talk a little bit about arrest. An officer can arrest someone either on a warrant or probable cause to believe the person committed a crime. Now remember, probable cause is more than reasonable suspicion. The officer must be able to point to objective facts that make it reasonable to believe a person committed or is committing a crime. Objectionable or object facts, objective facts, not objectionable. Maybe not enough coffee today. Objective facts. And we flesh that out in session 2. For example, based on the neighborhood burglaries and finding burglary tools in the pocket of the suspect during the pat-down, circumstance given in episode 2, the officer had probable cause. After the arrest, the officer can search the suspect and the immediate surroundings, including the black backpack the suspect had dropped on the ground when initially stopped. Person doesn't need to be in handcuffs or brought to jail for an arrest to occur, as we know. If it's clear to the person that he or she is not free to go, an arrest has likely occurred, and we know that's if they felt, which I'll discuss in a little greater detail in a few minutes. As introduced in episode 2 of this series, in general, a reasonable person wouldn't feel free to leave an encounter, or if a reasonable person wouldn't feel free to leave an encounter with the police, then there's been either a detention or an arrest. Now, sometimes it's clear when someone's under arrest. For instance, when the officer specifically says so and then handcuffs a person, pretty obvious. But as we know, not all situations are that clear, because it can mean the difference between incriminating evidence being admitted or not in a case. A judge is going to decide on the following factors. The scope of restraint. Was it brief or significant? We know the language of the court. And, you know, if you haven't been instructed to do this and you haven't clued in on it yet, clue in. I would suggest that you use some of these terms in your reports. An officer's brief and cursory holding and questioning of someone is a detention. So if you're describing it, I had a brief encounter. Use the words. An example is a police officer stopping someone who is behaving suspiciously in order to ask a few questions. The suspect isn't free to leave, but he also isn't under arrest, at least until the officer develops probable cause. Another common example is when you pull over a vehicle for some kind of traffic or equipment violation. An arrest, on the other hand, involves the police taking someone into custody through a more significant restraint or movement. And the quintessential example is handcuffs and advising them that they're under arrest. As with anything in the law, time is a factor, and the length of the stop, was it short or prolonged? Something the court's going to review. And in keeping with one of the themes of this episode, given that your encounters are going to be more likely than not videoed, time is going to be easy. The amount of time, the length of time, was it short or prolonged, is going to be easy to document. Investigatory stops, detentions, must be no longer than necessary, and the officers have to investigate with the least intrusive means reasonably available. If you prolong a detention beyond what is brief and cursory and you broaden it, then that detention may turn into a de facto arrest. That is, an actual but not official arrest. The person may feel they have no ability to leave. And again, since it's likely to be on video, the court's going to be able to take a look at and determine if that's the case. If a reasonable person in the suspect's position would have considered the police's behavior to constitute the kind of restraint that's typical to a formal arrest, an arrest has occurred. Now, as I noted in episode 2, some courts phrase the issue as depending on whether, after a brief questioning, a reasonable, innocent person would have felt free to leave. Felt free to leave. And if not, an arrest has occurred. Factors indicating detention is now an arrest, the amount of time, the amount of force, the need to use force, the number of officers involved, and we talked a little bit in episode 2 about the demeanor or location of the officers. They're all hovering within a foot around the suspect. Probably looks like an arrest, right? The manner in which officers physically handled the suspect, including the use of handcuffs, and then again, you know, time, the length. Miranda. The requirements of Miranda warnings came to us from the Supreme Court decision in Miranda versus Arizona in 1966, as you know. And in Miranda, the court held that a defendant cannot be questioned by police in the context of a custodial interrogation until the defendant is made aware of the right to remain silent, the right to consult an attorney and to have an attorney present for questioning, and the right to have an attorney appointed if indigent. Custodial interrogation. So, unable to leave and become the focus of an investigation. The Fifth and Sixth Amendments come into play under Miranda. These warnings stem from the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination and the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. And there are two Miranda triggers. The first trigger is custody, custodial. As we discussed, this doesn't necessarily mean being formally under an arrest. Any situation where the person may believe his or her freedom to move is substantially constrained, similar to an arrest, may serve as custody. The second trigger is interrogation, and this involves any questioning by law enforcement about a specific act, a specific crime, specific involvement. However, it's more than just direct questioning. If law enforcement engages in any action they should reasonably know may result in the suspect confessing or giving up information, this may also count in the court's eyes as an interrogation. Now, typically we say that we require both triggers. Miranda is required only when both of these triggers are present, custodial interrogation. If you have someone in custody, but you're not questioning that person, Miranda doesn't have to be read. And technically, you could have a circumstance where someone is not in custody, but could be subject to questioning. Now, this second option is more of a slippery slope, especially since once we begin to ask someone questions specific to criminal activity, the more likely the circumstance of whether they are in custody or whether they feel free to leave can become murky real fast. Now, some of you may have had me as students, and if you did, you've heard me tell you not to report back how you feel about some application of the law. Just give me the facts. Just give me the facts. How the law applies. Now, I'm an old and grizzled law dog. I'm more comfortable with where the expectations of the law keep us most of the time, and that's the objective facts of what is reasonable. We all know that we can move from conversation to general to focused questions fairly quickly. When we're encountering a situation, when we're talking to someone in the public, when we're talking to someone, whether or not we had suspicion that led us to talk to them, these things evolve quickly. My general advice, once questioning pivots towards being focused on an act or person, assume Miranda applies. Follow your department's procedure for delivering Miranda and trust things will end up where they should. CYA, or in a more civil sense, cover your butt. and protect the circumstance, hopefully and most likely with a good investigation, will lead to an arrest and, where warranted, a conviction. Let me expand on Miranda with a few comments here, and they concern consistent delivery. Carrier departments issued Miranda card as if it was as important as all the other things you are hopefully checking, double checking, and being sure you have on your person to remain safe and effective each and every shift. Be intentional about it. The card becomes worn, get a new one. Keep it in the same pocket. Keep it accessible. Take the card out when it's time to give Miranda warnings and read the card loudly, clearly, and in the same manner each and every time. Stand before your mirror at home, bathroom mirror. Read it. Look at yourself reading it. Your spouse or significant other comes in. Sure, they'll think you're crazy, but they probably already do, and you're practicing. You should know what you look like when you give it. Be professional. Do it the same way every time. And since the exchange is more likely than not to be captured on at least one video feed, maybe more, right? It's awfully difficult to dispute. Should your suspect decide to begin running off the mouth at the scene or on the drive back to the station, so whether you did what you were supposed to do, and again, you know, just weigh my cautions. Without Miranda, or a valid waiver of Miranda, statements made may be inadmissible at trial under the exclusionary rule, which prevents a party from using evidence at trial that would be gathered or have been gathered in violation of the United States Constitution. We're going to review the exclusionary rule in greater detail in the next episode. So let's talk about vehicle stops for a few minutes. Vehicle stops are unique in a way and not so unique in others. And, you know, here in our region where vehicles are a necessity largely to live, to get anywhere in a reasonable period of time, you need a vehicle, access to a vehicle, or someone who does have access to a vehicle. So even if you're not on a traffic detail, or even, you know, whether regardless of your department size, you're encountering vehicles. Now, we know that the majority of vehicle stops come with probable cause to stop, some sort of traffic violation witnessed by you as the officer. And in most cases today, those violations are recorded on dash cams, hopefully all. Sometimes, too many times for my ability to drive peacefully, the probable cause may come from you as the officer knowing the driver, because they're a frequent flyer in your community, someone you encounter often, and you know or suspect that they don't have a license. But you know the individual and you run them, and hey, they don't. Their license isn't valid, but there they are, behind the wheel. In any event, with vehicle stops, the reason for the stop is something above reasonable suspicion. In most cases, it's an actual and a lot of times depending on the location of your vehicle and what it captured video-wise, a clearly documented violation, crossing the center line, excess speed, running a red light, whatever it is. The stop results in a citation, warning, ticket, further investigation leads to probable cause to arrest. If there's probable cause to arrest, we can add in expectations for protective sweeps and the search issues that we will discuss in future episodes. But as many of you know, for whatever reasons, many drivers in a vehicle stop will consent to a search of the vehicle. Many, not all. If the stop leads to the driver being taken into custody, the vehicle can be impounded if your community has an impound ordinance. Under Illinois, a car or vehicle in any municipality may be impounded for the vehicle being used to commit a crime with the owner's consent, used to commit sex offenses, abandoned or stolen or unattended, DUI. If it's likely the driver will commit the violation again, obstructing the highway or creating a hazard on the highway, driving on a suspended or revoked license or without proof of insurance. Now, under those communities that have ordinances, the owner of the vehicle is subject to a fine. Typically, it's been $500 for way too long and needs to be ramped up because people plunk down the $500 like it's $50 anymore. The owner can request a hearing. It's under the preponderance of the evidence standard, so it's not that difficult for the city to prove or the municipality to prove. When we talk about owner's consent, it means the owner allowed the vehicle to be used by an individual or someone else who exercised control over the vehicle with the owner's consent. In other words, the vehicle was not stolen. And the only way to get out of that owner's consent in most cases, and I did this for over two decades, I heard these cases. I had a lot of scenarios. I only recall one where the vehicle had actually been reported stolen before the incident. And the vehicle has to have been reported stolen either right around the time of or before the incident. Only other time I recall ever letting somebody off, and that was with an agreement of everybody involved. This 80-year-old man whose kid had been in and out of prison. Kid ended up living with them. Kid was approaching 50 years old, I guess, and gave a big sob story. And the guy goes to sleep, and the kid took the car and was out doing things that would get the car impounded. But the gentleman came in and it kicked the kid out. And with the help of the police, the kid was told to stay away. And kid was going to be violated and sent back. But that was the only other time. In most cases, someone is allowing someone else to go out and drive a vehicle. And the whole focus of these ordinances is to cause people to be more responsible when they're letting people that shouldn't be driving a vehicle, or they know or should know that criminal activity is occurring because of those vehicles. Now, in the course of hearing all those cases, I saw dash cam video evolve from something that was uncomfortable and feared to something that was supportive and relied on for good police work. But as with some of the other comments I've made in this series focused on procedure, you have to be intentional, you have to be practiced, you have to be consistent with your use of this tool. Same with body cams. Follow procedure. Be intentional. You want to be focused on being professional and consistent in every situation you find yourself recording and/or on camera for in the course of every shift. At this stage, these are tools that can very much be used to assist you in doing your job safely, professionally, and consistently. Now, some of you may have been team sport athletes. And if you were in the last 20 years, it's likely that you watched videos of yourself or others to prepare for your next opponent or to improve your team's performance. Watch your dash cam, body cam video, and the video of your fellow officers, not only as a means of pursuing a case, but also toward improving your performance. Improving your professionalism, being intentional about your professionalism and your consistency in every action you find yourself in. It's a great tool. I mean, no debating that these things are an expectation. So flip it and use them to the best of your ability and use it for your time to improve and make your life easier. Make your existence in policing more enjoyable, more professional, and easier. When I was hearing cases, the only thing more painful than having to listen to a former student who didn't prepare to testify or didn't read his or her report, or worse, wrote a crappy report to begin with, was seeing that former student stumble through or appear less than they were capable of during an incident captured on dash or body cam video. Now, it didn't happen often, and I'm appreciative of that. And it happens to all of us at some point because we're not on our A game all the time. But as my final comments on this particular episode, I would urge you to use this tool to ramp up your own expectations for professionalism, being consistent, being intentional, doing things within the confines, the parameters of procedural law, and just making your whole life easier, less chaotic. That's it for these topics in this episode. We move on to a review of the exclusionary rule in the next session. Episode 4. I appreciate you. I hope you're well. And if you need me, you know where to find me.